Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Andy, Don, and Dude.
I believe in second chances for success, for fortune, and for fame.
It's a good thing.
Yes, it is. This is the Album Nerds Podcast. I'm Dude. I got Andy and Don with me. Andy, you ready to get sophomoric?
Get sophomoric. Got to look that up real quick.
No, it says C Album Nerds.
Hopefully that's good.
It basically means immature, but jejune, perhaps.
Jejune, like juvenile. Yeah, I think the podcast has been in that lane for quite a while, I would say.
Yeah.
Pretty comfortable there.
I've been in that lane for quite a few decades.
How you doing there, Don? Ready to go back to class?
Yeah, well, after, you know, biology or global studies, I think I'm going to try out for JV baseball.
I think you might have a good chance this year.
These are all things that happen in 10th grade, I think.
Yeah, that sounds about right. So this is the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums and the album format. And today we have an excellent show for you. We're going to be talking about three second albums that were big successes. Don's going to ask us a deep question. We're going to have some shout outs to some other albums and album related items we're digging. And then, of course, we'll spin that wheel of musical discovery to find out what we're talking about on the next show. But today it's all about sophomore successes.
That's what I'm talking about!
The concept of a sophomore slump is well known in the music industry, where an artist's second album often fails to live up to the commercial or artistic success of their debut. However, many artists have defied this trend by releasing sophomore albums that not only matched but surpassed their efforts, cementing their place in music history. Today, each of us will present a successful sophomore album.
Yeah, I mean, success can be dollars and cents, sales, fame, whatever, but it also can be artistic success. Some of the big names that come to mind for bands or artists that had sophomore successes, the Stooges, the Pixies, Black Sabbath, even Neil Young, Garth Brooks, and Public Enemy, these now incredibly known artists that really started to find their way on their second album and moving forward.
Weird Al.
Sure.
Incredible artist.
Andy, did you have any other favorites that you almost picked this week but ended up going in another direction?
Yeah. I mean, there's like so many good second albums here. The one I kind of made a little project for myself out of is my buddy Valentine and their sophomore album, Loveless, which is a pretty influential record on its own. The Dublin, Ireland shoegaze pioneers. I never really got into that record growing up, but I've been trying over the last few years to get into it and kind of understand it. And I did get to a place where I felt like I was pretty into the Loveless space. So it's great right before Valentine's, you know. how about you, Don?
Well, I was thinking of Interpol, their second album, Antics, from 2004. Interpol, I mean, they sound English, but they're actually from New York City. Got really into their first album, Turn on the Bright Lights, just kind of like Joy Division sounding, kind of post-punk moody stuff, but I felt like their second album, it was less derivative and it sounded like they were kind of creating their own distinct sound. So that's a good one. Dude?
Yeah, I mean, I went for one of the most obvious, especially for Gen Xers, the Nirvanas.
Nirvanas.
With Nevermind, released September of 1991. It's their second album, obviously, Bleach being their first, and it propelled raw energy and introspective lyrics and grunge and punk, and it just changed popular music at that time. And so, yeah, that was a success. Also,
it was.
But yeah, we've talked about that album on the show before, and it's just, this is not the time for it.
Ain't the time, ain't the place.
So why don't we get into our choices?
You choose me?
All right, for my sophomore success here, we're going with some low-hanging fruit. Talking about Led Zeppelin and their second studio album, Led Zeppelin 2.
Great title.
Yeah, very creative, right?
Well, I mean, when they're so close together, I mean, within the same year, it really is a two.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is the follow-up to their self-titled debut, which came out just in earlier January of 1969. This came out in October. Features a mix of originals and remakes of contemporary blues and folk music. Let's jump in and play the opening cut and the lead single, Whole Lot of Love.
I'm gonna give you my love.
Maybe that effect, is that the guitar? The
That's the Doppler effect.
Meow.
Just going by. yeah, I think that's Jimmy Page on guitar there. Yeah. Yeah, it really just kind of busts right out of the gates there with a pretty heavy, high energy cut there. It was a really popular song for them. Interesting history behind that song a little bit. Some of the lyrics were adapted from Willie Dixon's song "You Need Love," which was played by Muddy Waters in the 60s. Dixon would go on to sue Zeppelin because he wasn't credited in the 80s. Also some similarities to some Small Faces songs from the 60s. Definitely pulling from a lot of influences, but I think it's safe to say that they really did kind of define their own sound and really did define the sounds of many generations to come with this record here. That very like riff-based blues hard rock sound. It's pretty much the blueprint for it right here.
Yeah, how much do you suppose they were sued because of their blues influences? However, blues as a genre itself is nothing but influences from one another.
So people covering each other's songs. Yeah,
it's supposed to be a shared pot, right?
Yeah.
I think a lot of it had to do with just how successful they were, right? I mean, these guys were making all the money and all the tours. And anyway, my clickbait headline for Led Zeppelin 2 is Page & Co. ain't got time for a sophomore slump, delivering one of rock's definitive records while still touring their first. Kind of a crazy story here. They were touring in the US and UK for their first record, which really just came out a few months prior, and recorded this one on the road throughout a variety of different studios, mostly in the US from what I read. Wrote and recorded it on the road, which you don't hear bands doing that very often. They were just kind of that hot, I guess, at the time, and the creative juices were flowing. I think it's really impressive that this record sounds as amazing as it does for circumstances it was recorded under. It was just recently remastered about a decade ago. I think it just sounds incredible. It's so such a lively record, and it's so well mixed.
Well, when your sound is based completely on musicians and what your instruments and voices sound like, it really doesn't matter where you record it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if it's based on studio wizardry and tweaking stuff, then it does matter. But I think because they were not doing that, this was how they sounded.
Well, I mean, Led Zeppelin 1, to me, did sound kind of like a group of musicians recording in a room, where this sounds a little bit more intentional in terms of how it's put together. Like the pieces kind of all felt like they're more in the right places. All right, let's play another cut from the record here. This is track 3, The Lemon Zone.
Well, Zeppelin had performed Howlin' Wolf's The Killing Floor live a lot in this time period. And so that song became the basis for The Lemon Song. When they did it live, Plant often improvised the lyrics. That line, the famous line in it, "Squeeze my lemon till the juice runs down my leg."
Just wanted to read that one out loud, Don.
He really needed to go see a doctor about that.
The lemon juice, yeah.
That is a reference to Robert Johnson's Traveling Riverside Blues from 1937, but people believe that Johnson actually borrowed that from She Squeezed My Lemon by Art McKay from that same year. You know, so just a long, long legacy of lemon squeezing.
Yeah, and it just goes to show like how far you had to go with metaphor and innuendo back in the day instead of now people will just say things in songs. But
in 1972, Arc Music, who owned the publishing rights for Howlin' Wolf, of course, sued Led Zeppelin for copyright infringement. And that was settled out of court. And so now anytime the song appears, Howlin' Wolf gets co-writing credit. So there's a big echo effect on Plant's voice. Apparently, none of that is artificial. So, I mean, it's actually the studio space itself. It was a 16 by 16 foot wooden walled studio in Mystic Studios that creates that echo. All right. Well, my clickbait headline for Led Zeppelin 2 is Zeppelin's second effort makes album nerd shout, "Don't stop rocking."
No, 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 don't stop a rocking.
Yeah, I mean, this is just it's just a rocking explosion, you know. And it's been a few years since I've listened to this record straight through, and it's very heavy at times. I thought I was listening to Black Sabbath, but it's a little more bluesy, I think, than Sabbath. Lots of psychedelic stuff going on in there, but it's not over the top, you know, compared to a lot of the psychedelia of a couple years earlier. And they do throw in some kind of acoustic stuff in the middle, but they're like the Who in that it's it's just like everybody is just like top notch at their instrument.
Yeah, it's got an all-star cast.
Yeah, I mean, Page is, you know, an innovative guitarist. Plant's obviously, just a kind of, you know, bluesy rock singer. John Paul Jones is a great bassist. And, of course, John Bonham's what, thundering drums.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, why don't we hear one of those more folk-inspired tracks here? And this is track 7, Ramble On.
That's the stuff.
Ramble On, well-known folk-inspired track with the lyrics referencing J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings, and it blends acoustic and electric elements really well. It kind of is the precursor, I think, to that sound on the next album, Led Zeppelin 3, where they lean more into that folkiness. But it's really a testament to their ability to take their influences and on this album is when this really begins, when they completely shape their own interpretation and sound of that. It's not mimicry.
Nope.
You know, the Ramble On, I think it's Plant's way of speaking about his traveling troubadour sort of vibe. Yeah. You know, this traveling minstrel telling tales and living on the road and all that stuff. So yeah, I think it all works and fits into that Tolkien-esque world as well. My clickbait headline to describe Led Zeppelin 2, the one album that rules them all. And yes, it's my precious.
Oh, God. You okay?
Yeah, there's a little something in there. Got a little Gollum in the throat. So yeah, at this point, they're really refined that their sound, I think all that road time. And I think they got to the top of their creative peak here, but they stayed there for like 3 or 4 more albums. Mm. You know, there wasn't an immediate down the other side. So
yeah, it's a nice thing about when you're putting out records so quickly and your peak, you're at it for a while, longer. It's
yeah. Crazy. Well, you know, the Beatles were able to throw albums out there constantly. And I think that helps with the songwriting process. The whole album, all the tracks just come from the guts, you know, and you can feel it. And there's just something very visceral about their performances.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. It's it grabs you by the balls, that's for sure. One thing that struck me looking back on some reviews from back in the early 70s, a lot of folks just said it was just too noisy, too loud, all the songs sounded the same. I was really struck listening to, like, this is really, to me, it seems like a very diverse record. Yeah. I mean, there are heavy songs, there are blues-based songs, but there's a lot of interesting, quieter moments on here and some experimentation.
I think people just weren't ready for it.
Yeah, it was blowing their minds, man. All right, well, I don't think there's really, for me at least, much debate about the importance of this record. Yeah, it's, like I said earlier, it's really the blueprint for a lot of music that would come in the over the next 50 years, and I'm sure probably after that too. So for me, it's a shoo-in for the Album Nerds Hall of Fame. What do you gents think?
Yeah, this is a definite, you know, I think they really perfect that hard rock blues sound on this album, and it, you know, paves the way for heavy metal. So yes.
Yeah. Dude. Yeah, on the fence?
No.
The better question might be, what Zeppelin album doesn't belong in the Hall of Fame?
Yes.
So yeah, I obviously this is a landmark record, and like I said, they're kind of at their long lasting peak right here. But you know, some of the other tracks that really get to me are like Thank You and Living Loving Maid. She's Just a Woman, just that driving sound that they're capable of, and the tempo changes. It's just amazing how it feels like you're there, like you're a part of this creative process. It just feels so real and sounds real. So absolutely yes for me.
All right. Well, congratulations to Led Zeppelin. Welcome to the Hall of Fame. I have a feeling you might be back again in the future.
Absolutely.
Wow, what does Sylvester Stallone have to do?
I think because you said absolutely when in your thing, so it just had me think, you want a roommate?
Absolutely.
Before we get to our next sophomore success, let's hear from the worst podcast on Mars.
Worst
podcast ever.
I'm Amanda, and that's Evan. Say hi, Evan.
Hi, Evan.
And we're the hosts of The Worst Podcast on Mars. This is the podcast that talks music. And on Fridays, we work our way through the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's list of 200 definitive albums. I do a bunch of research trying to figure out why it's on this list. And on Tuesdays, we do smaller episodes that are not part of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's list. And Evan, well, he just literally shows up. So if that's what you're into, please find us on Apple Music or Spotify.
But not Mars. Yet.
My pick for a sophomore record is The Low End Theory by A Tribe Called Quest, which was released in September 1991. It's the second studio album, obviously, by the hip-hop group formed in Queens in 1985. Features MC and main producer Q-Tip, also MC Fife Dawg, and DJ and co-producer Ali Shaheed Muhammad. So this is the follow-up to their first album, People's Instinctive Travels and the Paths of Rhythm, which came out in 1990. Well, here's the opening cut. This is Excursions. Listen to the rhyme to get a mental picture of this black man,
black woman picture. Why do I say that? Because I got to speak the truth. What's happening here? Don's becoming the hip-hop curator here.
The hip-hop head. Yeah.
You wouldn't believe how much I enjoyed this record this week. <That's right. laughs> Like, oh, I got to listen to Zeppelin now. I got to go back to Troy.
What's going on?
Driving slowly through your cul-de-sac with your windows rolled down, sunglasses on.
My one hand on 12 o'clock on the wheel.
Yeah. Yep.
Anyway, so Excursions kind of has that minimalist jazz beat to it and a prominent bass line. Apparently, the bass line is sampled from Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, A Chant for Boo was the name of the song. So yeah, I mean, this kind of sets that jazz fusion tone for the record, which is a bit of a departure from their first album. Q-Tip is the lone MC on this particular song. Deals with several themes, musical heritage that starts out. He's actually talking about a conversation with his dad about the connection between bebop jazz and hip hop. You've got Afrocentricity in there. He's mentioning African heritage and the Zulu nation, artistic integrity. So, you know, authenticity in hip hop and personal growth. And so that's where the Excursions, you know, kind of comes in. Just so different from the NWA record that we listened to a couple of weeks ago.
Right. East Coast versus West Coast, man. Holy cow.
Yeah. And there's I didn't notice it until I was reading about it, but there's barely any profanity on this album.
Yeah.
I don't even think it gets an explicit sticker on it.
I had read that Ron Carter, who's on one track, wouldn't play on a record with too much profanity, so maybe they cut back. I'm not sure.
Yep, that's the stand-up bass player they brought in. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, my clickbait headline for The Low End Theory is Q-Tip swabs ears with innovative sounds and thoughtful lyrics.
Sorry. Yeah, why'd you have to go there?
It's gross.
Well, yeah. And not many people know this, but Don's rap name is Cotton Swab, which is just, you know, the generic name for a Q-Tip.
Yeah, so the big differences between this and their first album was, again, you know, mostly that jazz influenced, you know, style, but it's a more, I think, refined and cohesive sound. The first one was a bit more eclectic. There's actually more Fife Dawg on this one, and there's more sort of back and forth between Q-Tip and Fife Dawg than you get on the first record. And actually, if you go later into their, you know, into their discography, there's more of that interplay between the two of them. Anyway, let's hear some more. Here's the final cut on the album, Scenario.
Oh, there's the F.
Her little MF there.
Count on Buster Rhymes to get one of them.
Yeah, so that collaboration and everything is really at the forefront here for Scenario, featuring leaders of the New School, which was Buster Rhymes' group at the time. That was his set of rhymes on that track. And just the feel, the party feel. This whole album just feels like a summertime soundtrack, like something to play and you know, play some frisbee golf with your... It just sounds like something to play at the beach or whatever. It's just so fun to listen to. And this final track leaves you in that kind of mood. Rah, rah, like a dungeon dragon. Love that line. The layered production, of course, features those subtle jazz influences and that bass, that low-end sound that permeates on the album. And Scenario has been sampled, referenced, and paid homage to many, many times by even the Insane Clown Posse, I read somewhere.
Juggalo for life. Boom, boom.
If you can inspire those guys.
Well, that's saying something, yeah.
My clickbait headline to describe Low End Theory: the record that had you vibing to bass lines while your beeper buzzed in 4/4 time. Are beepers mentioned like way too much on this? There's a whole song.
Sky Pager, whatever.
Sky Pager. And then there's other mentions of their beepers buzzing and stuff. It just, be careful, songwriters, about the technologies that you mention in your songs. Unless you're going to explain what they are to the folks a couple decades later listening to it.
There's also a lot of Arsenio Hall on this album. I mean, must mention him at least 5 times.
It was a big deal.
I'm sure they were guests on the show, and if you want to keep appearing. So yeah, I mean, this is a classic hip-hop record that I've owned for a long time, and I don't have a lot of them in my collection, but this is just an infectious sound. Q-Tip, it just has one of the best voices and flows. It's just so smooth and jazzy also. It just works really well here.
I read that he actually had a cold during the recording sessions, and he wanted to go back and re-record his vocals, but people said it sounded fine. But hearing it after that, I'm like, oh, he does kind of sound,
a little congested,
a little clogged up.
Never thought about that.
All right, well, let's hear a little more. Here's Check the Rhyme.
Extremity of rhythm, yeah, that's what you heard. So just clean out your ears and just check the word. Check the rhyme.
Check the Rhyme is the first single from Low End Theory. It's got that great stand-up bass sound, which is prevalent throughout the album. I think a pretty killer verse from Fife Dawg there. He really steps up on this record and kind of, at least for me, kind of solidified himself as a real force, not only in this group, but in the 90s hip-hop in general. My clickbait headline for Low End Theory is Tribe Theorize a Smooth, Groovy Hip-Hop Classic. Yeah, I mean, I'll just kind of second everything you guys had said. This is one of those A-plus standout hip-hop albums for me. There's not a bad moment on it. I think you could argue maybe it gets better as it goes on, but it starts out in a pretty good place and ends up in a really good place. So it's a pretty nice trip to make. Yeah, definitely a big maturation process from the debut. I think in particular Q-Tip and the production does sound much more intentional, and it's much more interesting too, I think. That jazz influence is obviously a big part of it, but also it's got a good feel to it. The bass, I love the bass sound. I wish more hip-hop would have this kind of like live bass feel to it. I know it's sampled, but it does feel like so big in the mix. It just sounds cool.
Yeah.
It actually, the jazz treatment, I think, works a lot better than that. Remember that Guru record we did where he was like truly just rapping over jazz?
Jazzmatazz?
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is better.
Yeah, but I mean, that was actually, on Jazzmatazz, that music was performed specifically for the album.
I think the problem with that record was the music is so busy that I think it makes it hard to really make rhymes work over it. Whereas with this, it just seems to be a better marriage.
Yeah, I think that this is a more natural sounding collaboration between those genres. But I think that Guru is trying to take the next step and make it an actual jazz album. So they're kind of in different categories. But
I'm not dissing Guru.
Yeah, it feels like you are. So I'm getting a little jazzed up over here.
Kind of coming right at him there. I don't know.
Cool. All right. Well, I mean, it sounds like we're all pretty positive on this album. So, you know, as the official, you know, hip hop guy on the show, I'm going to nominate this. I'm going to nominate this for the Album Nerds Hall of Fame.
Going out on a limb there, Don. Appreciate it.
So what can you replace Donnie Likey with that's specific to hip hop albums?
Donnie Vibin. Yeah, I on first listen, I wasn't that excited, but basically, like the second time around, I got really into it. It does seem like this is a pretty innovative record. I also want to mention the mixing engineer, Bob Power, gets a lot of credit for this record for removing a lot of the surface noises, crackles, and pops that you hear a lot, like in particularly like in 80s hip hop. You know, all these samples sound really lo-fi, and I think they do a really good job on this album. But yes, the Low End Theory belongs in the Hall of Fame. What do you think, dude?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I've, as I said, this is one of those albums that I made an exception for, even in my rock music onlyest of days. You know, I think tracks like What? And Buggin' Out. Yeah, What is just so smart. Yeah. And Buggin' Out is just so fun as a second song after Excursions. They did a great job with sequencing, with figuring out what goes where. Everything fits perfectly, and it's just a pleasure to listen to. And like hearing all these voices and funny lines, and it sounds like everyone's bringing each other to the next level, and that's great to hear. So absolutely yes for me.
Andy?
Yes, definitely. It's all the things you guys have said and more, and deserves to be there. I think it's definitely the definitive Quest record, and it's a great representation of 90s hip hop. So
if we were doing this right, we would have wrapped that entire presentation.
Yeah. Leave that up to Q-Tip.
Don't forget Cotton Swab.
Right, well, congratulations, A Tribe Called Quest. The Low End Theory is now part of the Album Nerds Hall of Fame.
Excuse me, I'd like to ask you a few questions.
Yeah, it's time again for Deep Questions by Don. So we're dealing with a lot of albums today that are as good or better than the original. What are some cases where a sequel is better than the original?
Yeah, I think this does happen occasionally in movies. I think Terminator 2 would be like the most obvious one that I could think of.
Okay. Well,
you mean T2? Right.
Maybe there's a couple other ones. But one that I really did appreciate a lot recently, well, not recently, within the last 20 years, The Dark Knight. I think that in every way it really does outdo Batman Begins, especially the scope, but also the performances I think are significantly better.
Well, the bad guy is certainly more interesting than Ra's al Ghul or whatever.
Why so serious?
Yeah, definitely. But I think the one I would hang my hat on is Evil Dead 2, which is pretty much a remake of Evil Dead 1, but with a lot more money and better understanding of how to make movies, I think, on Sam Raimi's part there. Yeah, one of my favorite horror comedy movies of all time. How about you, dude?
Well, not to rain on your parade, but I think Army of Darkness is way better than Evil Dead 2.
This is my boomstick!
But that's the third one in the series.
It's not a sophomore, though. I mean, come on.
No. But it's still a follow-up.
Sure.
Yeah, so one of the most obvious ones, I think, is Empire Strikes Back. To me, that I'm not a big Star Wars guy, but I grew up with it as a kid, and that was the first one I actually saw. It's dark. It's... I mean, Nick, you know, Yoda is a little eye-rolly, but...
Yoda's awesome, man. Come on. Really?
But there's not a bunch of cutesy crap going on in it, and...
Oh, the Ewoks you're talking about.
Yeah. The bad guys win.
No, yeah. I am the father.
It went against a lot of the things you expect in a movie at that time, and like a movie full of heroes and brothers and sisters that make out, so... Yeah. For sure, I think that still to me is the best of the movies.
Yeah, I agree. I was thinking of the world of video games, and that's a case where it's easier to be better the second time around because generally technology is improving.
Helps,
yeah. But Ms. Pac-Man, right, was kind of the sequel to Pac-Man, even though it was developed by a different company. I mean, it's more to it than just having the throwing the bow on her. The fruit moves around the screen instead of staying in one place.
It was big innovations.
You remember, you could go through like the tunnel to go to the other side.
Yeah.
There's like four of those on some of the screens. So, I mean,
sounds like you were a big fan.
For me, music looks slightly different on Ms. Pac.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Music is totally different.
For me, the big draw for that one, you know, I didn't get to play it much, but if I went to the grocery store with my dad, he'd play it. Because they had Ms. Pac-Man in the lobby. I'd get to watch Because I would just waste the quarter. Put it in. I'm dead. Game over. So the cartoon little story between levels when they'd show Ms. Pac-Man and Pac-Man meeting and, you know, popping out some babies and all that stuff. I liked that. Yeah.
They show that?
Yeah, they get into this thing. They play Barry White. The two of them make sweet love. They become one Pac person. It's beautiful.
Nice. Completed the circle.
Oh, my God. All right. What other sequels were better than the originals? Let us know. Hit us up on Instagram or Facebook, or leave a comment on our website, albumnerds.com.
All right, so for my sophomore success album pick, I'm going with, something from the 90s. Shocking, I know. Smashing Pumpkins.
Pumpkins?
And the Smashing Pumpkins. I think it's a hipper take on Smashing Pumpkins. Siamese Dream from July of 1993. Smashing Pumpkins were formed in Chicago in 1988. Original members who are on this record, Billy Corgan, James Iha, Darcy Retzky, and Jimmy Chamberlin. And they're known for this distinctive, intricate sound and incorporates elements of gothic rock, heavy metal, grunge, psych rock, prog rock, shoegaze, dream pop, electronica. And they do it well. Why don't we start off with a little bit of Today? All right, boys, I don't know about you, but for me, I remember sitting in my room plucking that ding, 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 ding to make people think I knew how to play guitar. Mm-hmm. Did you guys ever try that one?
I think everyone in my high school tried that one.
Yeah. I usually did wish you were here. Down, ding,
ding, ding. Of course.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Back to Pink Floyd, son of a bitch. All right. So Today opens with the deceptively simple 5-note riff that we were just playing around with. And that contrast between the light intro, the heavy guitars, the dynamic range, the layering. I remember listening to this song and being like, yes, today is a good day. Because this was a time in my life when I really had no worries or cares. And yes. I didn't really get to the fact that it's essentially he's super depressed.
Yeah.
Feeling suicidal, he said in an interview, and then thought it would be funny to just say, oh, today's the greatest day. It's sarcastic. Yet for me, this album and this song were the bright spot in the grunge haze and clouds.
It's an uplifting sounding song, I would say.
Yeah.
But I think he's implying that he's not getting to tomorrow.
Right.
Yeah.
Yikes. Yeah, and Butch Vig was the producer on this, also produced Nevermind, but the details, it was all in the details, and that intense layering of like 30 layers per song of guitar sounds, and this kind of nod to 70s prog and bands like Boston and Queen that were producing these big sounding pop rock records. And I was reading that Billy Corgan was kind of thumbing his nose at alternative music and the rules. You know, you couldn't have strings, you couldn't have joyful sounds, it all had to be dark and dank, and you couldn't celebrate big sounding rock and roll anymore, which they totally did here. My clickbait headline to describe Siamese Dream: the album that dared to bring strings, big pop hooks, and crushing guitars to a genre obsessed with sounding miserable. They nailed it. Yeah, this was a bright spot in a dreary landscape, even though beneath the surface it was also dreary. So, all right, why don't we listen to a real happy song? This one's called Disarm.
Such a pretty but dark song, written at the same day, I believe, as he wrote Today. Corrigan there. It's about his parents and some abuse he suffered growing up. Yeah, I think it ties into the attempted suicide as well by Corrigan there. The quote I found from Corrigan was, "I didn't have the guts to kill my parents, so I thought I'd get back at them through song." Pretty heavy stuff there.
Yeah, he could have changed that quote to, "I would never kill my parents because that's wrong." Not, "I didn't have the guts." That freaks me out a little.
Yeah, right. All right. My clickbait headline for Siamese Dream is, "The Pumpkins leave the gish behind for a more focused Corrigan and some angry Vic guitars I think this is a huge step forward from what they were doing on their previous record, Gish.
Yeah.
That record is very, in my opinion, very kind of murky and just, it sounds constantly like it's getting distracted and doesn't really have a clear modus operandi.
Mm-hmm.
This album definitely does, or is much more focused in comparison, right, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, Gish was on like Caroline Records, and then when they got signed to Virgin, that's when it was like, pressure's on, go be rock stars. You've got, you know, we think based on Gish that you've got the stuff.
Yeah. There was a lot of hype around them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, of course, back in 93 or 4, anyone that wanted to show you they were cooler than you, oh, Gish is my favorite album. So the people go, what's Gish? And they'd be like, oh, the Smashing Pumpkins' first album. I got caught in that trap myself.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty big step back. I really, the songwriting I don't think is nearly as sharp. And really, I think that the pumpkin sound, I think, is defined here on Siamese Dream, that sort of like, mm-hmm, loud, soft dynamic. And Corrigan's voice really comes into its own here, I would say, in terms of how he uses it and how it's treated here, I guess.
It's like ghostly somehow.
Yeah, it is creepy. Coming back to this record, I think the thing that struck me most is the just awesome guitar sound that I assume Vig was very involved with. It just sounds so freaking cool, man. It just rips through some of these cuts, and it's almost sounds supernatural in a way. Like, it's just so punishing and otherworldly sounding. I really love it, especially when they lean into it, which on a handful of tracks here do get a little bit heavier. But and for me, there are some tracks that I think do kind of lose the thread a little bit, especially as they get into the second half of the album. Just a little bit overly long and maybe not quite as interesting. Mayonnaise and Space Boy, I think, are a little bit boring for me. Soma, for me, really kind of is just about 3 minutes too long in the middle of the record. It's a sweet song, but you could have cut out some of that stuff. And then maybe that's a symptom of the 90s a little bit too. It's a long record.
Yeah. I try to remember that when we're listening to albums from this era, that it's not their fault. It's not the band's or producer's fault that there's songs that might go to, they were just trying to fill 70 minutes every time. So this album is full of odd song titles. Mm. This one is no exception. Let's listen to Silver Fuck.
I almost hurt myself to that song many times.
Oh, sure.
So speaking of long songs, that's the longest on the record. It comes in at 8 minutes and 42 seconds, and it's epic. You know, it's a roller coaster. I would say the loudest and hardest moments of the record are on this, and probably the quietest are there as well. You know, I mean, there's this long ambient section in the middle, and his vocals become whispery and stuff. There's that part where he's like, "Bang bang, you're dead, hole in your head." I don't know. It's a freaky song. I guess it became a live favorite for a few years, and I could see that. I never had the pleasure of seeing the Smashing Pumpkins, but I think that would have been probably something to come at the end of the set. You know, just a big epic tune. The guitars and bass guitars are tuned to drop D. So if you're trying to play it at home,
drop that D. Wow. Drop that D. That has so many potential connotations. I have to get a t-shirt.
Right. Well, my clickbait headline for Siamese Dream is Corrigan smashes alt-rock rivals with depressing but uplifting epic. So, you know, as we've mentioned before, I mean, the lyrics are dark as hell.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for some reason, the musical treatment, and I guess it's, you know, sort of that shoegazy dream pop feel, all those layered guitars and stuff. There's some sort of optimism in it, you know, that keeps you going. And I think he does a really great job with that.
It reminds me of bands like Boston, right? Where the sound and the attention to detail in the guitars and the layers and all that can set a tone that might be counter to what the lyrics might be saying, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When I think of, when people say alternative rock, you know, from the 90s, this is kind of the sound that I have in mind, you know, that just the distorted feedback-y guitars that are sort of just blended together in this mix, but it's also, you know, melodic. Yeah. I kind of see it as like a quintessential 90s alt rock album.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, there's so many great songs on it. And so you listen to this record and you don't even realize how many of them you recognize sounds from anyway. You know, songs like Rocket and, of course, Cherub Rock, which we did not talk about today. But that song just crushes you at the beginning of the album. And but then it takes you on a flight somehow too. It's really cool. So yeah, Smashing Pumpkins. They smashed it on their sophomore album. Just a beautiful growth in their sound and such a fun 90s record to listen to. So yeah, go check out Siamese Dream by the Smashing Pumpkins. You will not regret it.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
All right, well, I guess we're done with our sophomore experience. So moving into our junior years, I guess.
God.
That summer where maybe you got your first job or learned how to drive. All right, what are you guys digging?
I got a couple things here in my backpack with papers and rulers falling out.
You carried rulers in your backpack? What a nerd.
A variety of rulers, yeah. All right, first one for me is a debut solo album from an artist named Lauren Mayberry, who is the singer and percussionist from the pop dance group Churches. You guys familiar with Churches?
Yeah. Churches with the V.
With the V, that's right. The album's called Vicious Creature. Let's play Shame. Usually a genre I spend a lot of time with, but this is very catchy and anthemic, just uplifting. I've been enjoying it quite a bit. She's got a knack for writing catchy songs.
Yeah, I picture you, Andy, just got out of the shower, you got a towel on your head, and you're singing into your brush.
You're not wrong. All right, and then the last one for me here is from a guy I didn't know was still putting out music, Franz Ferdinand. He's got a new album out, or they have a new album out.
I was going to say, now it's just the guy is Franz Ferdinand, like Alice Cooper?
No, they're a four-piece, I believe, from Glasgow, Scotland. They have a new album out called The Human Fear. It's their sixth studio album. The album deals with searching for the thrill of being human via fears. Let's play track 4, Hooked. Oh, you got me
hooked. Wow, what's happening to you this week, Andy?
Dancing this week, right? This is a very diverse record. There's some songs that kind of sound like what I thought Franz Ferdinand sounded like.
Bing, 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 ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, yeah. There's other songs, though, that are very different. Very fresh sounding. I enjoyed it quite a bit so far.
Nice.
What you been digging on, Dan?
Well, I discovered that Bob Mould, famously of Husker Du and Sugar, has a new album coming out March 7th called Here We Go Crazy. Here's a little bit of the title track.
Bob's getting all mellow.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear the rest of the album. All right. And another band I had heard of, but I hadn't paid much attention to, Flip Turn. They're a band from Fernandina Beach, Florida, formed in 2015. There's an album called Burnout Days, which came out earlier this month. There's a song called Rodeo Clown.
I was thinking it was going to be more punky or something based on Flip Turn. Sounds like a skateboard thing or something.
Yeah. There's harder or edgier stuff on the record, but yeah, you know, pretty poppy indie rock, I would say. How about you, dude?
This week, I've been listening a little bit to a band named Dits and their 2025 album, Never Exhale. It's their second studio album, so hopefully this is a sophomore success. We shall see. They're based out of Brighton, England. They're a noise rock band, and their first album is called The Great Regression, which had quite a bit of critical success. This album showcases the fusing of post-punk and noise rock and abrasive textures, relentless tension, and kind of reminds me of bands like Idols and the Gila Band. But why don't we check out a little bit of Taxi Man? I guess maybe my Fontaine's DC obsession is leading me in these directions as well.
I'd just be excited to say, hey, I'm putting on the dits.
Oh, God. All right, so I like to always go back to the old music collection, and something I picked up fairly recently was Warren Zevon's Excitable Boy on vinyl. It's a 1978 album. It's his third studio album. It blends rock, folk, jazz influences. There's kind of sardonic, sort of tongue-in-cheek storytelling. Explores themes of violence, obsession, and madness. But it's, of course, highlighted by Werewolves of London is the big song off of there. But why don't we listen to a little bit of Johnny Strikes Up the Band.
Steady, get ready. Rock steady when Johnny strikes up the band.
Such an interesting guy, interesting voice. Like, it's hard to know what to make of him. Is he a Springsteen type of guy? Is he... Yeah. You know, what is he?
You're just saying, is he Tom Waits? Is he?
Yeah, that's what I like about him. When you think of some of the most interesting artists from the late 70s and early 80s, he's kind of a composite of all of it. It's a great listen.
So what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Also on our website, albumnerds.com.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, it's about that time on the show, and I'm reminded of the great American author F. Scott Fitzgerald, who said, "Never confuse a single defeat with a final defeat." Mm. With that in mind, let's bring out my friend and yours, Wadbot, to see what we'll be talking about on next week's episode.
Music is personal, but it's even more meaningful when shared. Next time, you will be diving into the albums that live in your significant other's collections, the records they love, the ones they may have introduced you to, and the sounds that shaped them.
Your lover's music collection. Yeah, so that's apropos for Valentine's Day. Hopefully these are romantic albums. If they're not, then what will that say about our relationships?
Yeah, well, what's your favorite thing in your partner's music collection? What else are you listening to? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Album Nerds. And visit us at albumnerds.com to suggest topics for the show, peruse the Hall of Fame, and listen to all 277 episodes. Also, the best way to support the show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you for joining us on the Album Nerds podcast. We'll catch you next time with our lover's favorites.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Catch you next week.
Hey, mama said the way you move, gonna make you sweat, gonna make you groove.
No.
Lord, no.
That just sounds like a guy talking like this.
Need to be in that small wooden room, Don. You get the vibrato.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got to grow your hair out if you're going to sing like Robert Plant.
Well, that helps too, yeah. Get some tiny jeans.
Yeah, the tighter the jeans, the higher your voice.